The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Mark Bowden, and I'm here to introduce someone who, to those of you who've been around long enough in Philadelphia, does not need an introduction. Years ago, when I was a reporter at the Inquirer, when someone found out that that's where I worked, they would say, "Do you know Steve Lopez?" He was easily the most popular writer in town. His columns for the paper, many of which have been published in a collection ironically entitled Land of Giants, were slyly funny, smart, and caring. In what is today mostly a lost art, Steve managed to skewer our local pals with kindness, calm wit, and a sensibility that I would call outraged common sense. Here's how he described the late city councilwoman Joan Krajewski and her colleague Ann Land in 1988. He had dubbed them the Boom Boom Sisters. "I'd let them run a gambler's express to Atlantic City. The Boom Boom Sisters have already shown an interest in games of chance, having recently returned from official business at the League of Cities convention in Las Vegas, where they missed most of the educational workshops, but learned that two lemons and a plum equals zero." He was suggesting that the Boom Boom Sisters use a van that he dubbed the Council Mobile, a vehicle purchased by the city ostensibly to provide or help provide constituent services, which was actually parked in a garage and never used. So at one point, Steve hijacked it and drove it around City Hall, shouting out to the city council president, Joe Coleman, that he could have a ride if he wanted to. And he later told Philadelphia Magazine, "This is the kind of highbrow journalism that people remember me for." To the lasting regret of Philadelphians, Steve moved back to his home state of California in the 1990s, and after a few stops here and there, landed with a local column in the Los Angeles Times, where he quickly forged a similar reputation. This is a place where, you know, they have pretty good baseball team and football team, but, you know, decidedly second tier. He wrote with humor and sensitivity about himself, about local political characters, and the pressing issues of the city and the region. I won't list all the awards and formal acclaim. You can Google it. He focused a great deal of his efforts in LA on their huge problem with homelessness, and in the process met and befriended Nathaniel Ayers, a troubled Juilliard-trained violinist living on the streets. His columns about Ayers became the award-winning book, The Soloist, and a movie by the same name. That work acquainted millions more readers with the remarkable depth of reporting and feeling in Steve's work, which goes far beyond his occasional stunts. In recent years, he found himself writing more and more about the growing wave of fellow baby boom elders in California. About 6 million people aged 65 and older now live there, and that figure will double by 2030. He recently reinvented his column, which is now called The Golden State. This new effort is a natural evolution for Steve, who, like me, is already past what we used to think of as retirement age. His newest book, Independence Day, which we'll talk about this evening, looks at that question, one that we have all faced or will face. What do you do with yourself when you no longer have to work? Do you retire and live the good life? What exactly is the good life? Do you reinvent yourself completely? Or do you put your head down and keep doing what you've always done? The book offers the typical Lopez blend of personal reflection and creative reporting that looks at the endless variety of ways Americans are answering those questions and lets us in on his own struggle with them in his own life. Charming, informative, and thought-provoking, It shows Steve in his golden years, still at the top of his game. So yes, I do know Steve Lopez, and he's back with us tonight. Steve? All right, Steve, where have you been for the last 20 years?
I've been waiting for the Eagles to get into the Super Bowl. You know, good things happened right after I left. Well, the Eagles did go to the Super Bowl. Vince Fumo went to prison. I mean, all of this good stuff happened right after I left. I feel cheated.
Well, stick around. We've got a great baseball team and a terrific football team now. So, and the Inquirer could use you, I think.
Vince Fumo is not here tonight, is he? I hope.
Steve was a little concerned about being heckled tonight.
I thought you were going to be heckled.
So tell us about what you've been doing out in California.
So I've been out there. It's hard to believe. Well, let me say, first of all, how good it is to be back in Philadelphia, which still, in so many ways, feels like home, partly because just upstairs from where we sit right here tonight, I got married. I got married in the free library here, and I brought my bride with me from California. She's out there somewhere. I don't know where. Raise your hand. Stand up. Oh, there she is. Yeah, I got married in the library. How many people can say that? It just seemed like a good place to have a wedding. We were walking by one day. We had just met and thought, let's go in and see if they do marriages. I so much miss and love Philadelphia that, in fact, my son Andrew is here with his girlfriend Maggie. We've been talking all day about should we go in together on a house somewhere in Philadelphia. We'll split it. And so tonight I want to use this opportunity to ask if anybody here has a granny flat that you'd be willing to sell or rent to us to make this a little bit easier, because prices have gone up a bit in Philadelphia since I last lived here. So I left for California and became a columnist, as you said, at the LA Times. And I've been doing pretty much there what I did here. And can't believe it's already over 20 years that I've been doing it. The other thing I wanted to say is how honored I am that you are here with me. And we go back to living in the same neighborhood in Mount Airy with our kids growing up. A lot of Mount Airy representation here tonight. Great. And I'm honored that you agreed to do this, and it's so nice to reconnect with you. So I've been writing the same kind of column essentially in California, which is the state that I was born in, that I did here. It's a little bit of rattling cages. It's a little bit of wandering the streets and different neighborhoods looking for good stories to tell. And that still is something that I find very gratifying, although having done it for half a century, I got to thinking that maybe it was time to call it quits. Right. Which is why that's where this came from.
Well, one of the things that I was telling Steve earlier that, you know, I was kind of the ideal reader for this book because I'm at a similar stage in my life wrestling with a lot of the same questions. And I also know Steve and have known him for a long time. And this book, in addition to dealing with these questions of retirement, how to spend your older years, is a memoir of sorts where we learn a lot about Steve's life. Which he needs to tell, I guess, to set us up for the crisis that you found yourself in when your youngest child was heading off to college. Want to talk about that?
Yes, I was not looking forward to being an empty nester. I know that a lot of people are, but I was not looking forward to that. And it may be because for almost my entire adult life, I had kids in the house. It was Jeff, it was Andrew. Then it was Caroline. And as I was thinking about retirement, I began to worry that, and this was good advice, somebody who said, you know, if you don't have an office to go to anymore and you don't have a job to go to and the house is suddenly empty, you're looking at a double void. And how are you going to be able to handle that, and how are you going to fill the hours of the day? And I found that that idea pretty terrifying, because I just liked being around them, and I'm not sure how I would fill all of that time. I did find that during the pandemic, I was writing the book during the pandemic, and during the pandemic, our office was closed. The LA Times shut its doors, and we were mostly working from home. I was still out on the streets reporting, but mostly working from home. And I thought, well, this could be okay, you know. I get up, I don't have to get into the car, I'm not stuck in traffic. And I said to, and Allison works as a freelance writer and editor out of our home. And so suddenly we're sharing a lot more time than we had in the many years since we were married just upstairs. And I said to her one day, this pandemic is kind of a preview of my retirement, because I'm home a lot. And she said, if this is a preview, I do not want to see the movie. You better get yourself some friends and find some things to do, because I'm younger than you, and I'm not going to be your play date every day. So I realized in that moment that I couldn't retire. I had to keep going.
And she could beat you at tennis, too, so that wouldn't have been fun.
It's not fair, because, you know, I look at this. I have a brace on my ankle here. I have a number of injuries, and she has no mercy on the tennis court. She runs me. She actually runs me on the tennis court.
Yeah, I remember people like that. You know, those of us who have never written a column, which is, how many days a week were you writing your column?
At the Inquirer?
And then in L.A.?
You know, I've had different schedules in my career. For a while at the San Jose Mercury News, I wrote four columns a week, which was insane. And you're guaranteed to write some really, really shitty columns if you're writing four columns a week. Not that I didn't write shitty columns when I was only doing two a week, but at the Inquirer, I started at three columns a week. And people would ask me, is it difficult to find, how do you figure out what to write about? That's not the hard part. Let me tell you what the hard part was. And I think there's some former colleagues in here, editors too. The hardest part about writing the column was that it ran top left of the Metro page down to the bottom. It did not jump. Jump meaning you didn't have to turn the page to read the end of it. And what that meant was that for 12 years, I had to write a column that was either 17.76 inches long, 17.62 inches, 17.49, 17.36, or 17.23. And I remember those numbers because I can't forget them. I wake up, these are nightmare numbers for me. So it would take like maybe 2 or 3 hours to write the column, but it was like 19 inches or it was 15 inches.
Yeah, and then your work starts.
Having to make it fit the space was cruel and unusual punishment.
Steve actually writes about the burden of having that column on him, on his shoulders every day. He writes this: I'm in my fifth decade of being ruled by deadlines, which requires constant vigilance. Sometimes I'm awakened in the middle of the night by a hungry beast that has to be fed constantly. What's the next column? Do I have any decent ideas? When's the last time I really knocked one out of the park? I lie there wondering if the mayor needs a good flogging, or if there's something clever that I haven't already said about pitchfork militants who refuse to wear masks because it infringes on their constitutional rights. In my job, you have to produce without excuse. It's not like fishing, where you can go out on a boat, come back, and say you didn't catch anything today.
You know, it is a burden. It has worn me down a bit, but it's also exciting, and the pressure is exciting. And I've had the good fortune of working in cities where there is no shortage of material. I landed and got an email from Dave Davies at WHYY saying that the Pen and Pencil Club had, I don't know what it was, it something of a quiz about Super Bowl moments and football in Philadelphia, and there were these, it was, I guess it was like a multiple choice. Who was the local politician who bet somebody that he could not reach the field with a snowball during that famous debacle when the game had to be stopped because people were throwing, you know, beaning players and referees? And Dave sent me this because that was one of the multiple choice questions. And the answer, does anybody in the room know the answer?
I think I know the answer. And shout it out if you know the answer. I would vote Rendell, yeah.
Ed Rendell, and so, yeah. Like, how hard is it to write a column in a city where I'm at my desk and somebody calls and says, hey, I went to the Eagles game, or Eagles game, I should say, and it's such an embarrassment, and snowballs are flying, and I see Ed Rendell talking to somebody and pulling out his wallet and betting him $20 that he cannot reach the field. And so I thought, okay, at the time, Ed Rendell was the district attorney. Now, if you're the district attorney, it means you are the top law enforcement official in the city, in the county. And you would think that's the person who's going to take charge of this unlawful situation. So I called Ed, and he was getting on a plane, as I recall, and I said, Ed, were you, you go to the Eagles game? Yeah, yeah. You happen to be sitting in section 647? Yeah. Like row 6? Yeah. Did you bet a guy that he couldn't reach? And he said, absolutely not. That's a bunch of bullshit. And so I sat there thinking, what am I going to do with that? He's denying it. Is that a column? 10 minutes later, the phone rings. It's Ed. Steve, I lied. So look, what I can't believe about my time in Philadelphia is that I was paid to write the columns. They fell into your lap. You know, Steve Seplow is here. He was the Metro editor. And I remember covering the mob trial when Nikki, little Nikki. And, yes. And who was that? I better watch what I say here, right? Yeah. But there were 9 of them on trial for murdering Sal Testa. Sal Testa was shot twice in the back of the head. So I wrote columns saying things like, it was a suicide. The second bullet was Sal's, I just want to make sure. And I said, you know, when they're convicted, they already have their prison softball team. So they were all acquitted, and they had a big party at the Four Seasons, which I stupidly attended. And I was run out of there. They threatened to kill me. And I ran across Logan Circle all the way back to the Philadelphia Inquirer, out of breath. And Steve Seplow, the Metro editor, where is Steve, that bastard? Where is Steve? Because there he is. I said, I just got thrown out of a mob party. And he said, well, sit down and write the column. And I said, but if I write the column, they'll kill me. And Steve said, but it'll be a great column.
And we'll get somebody else to do the next one. Yeah,
yeah, thank you. Thank you, Steve.
You mentioned Ed Rendell, and I remember, you know, this is a great city to report in. And one of the things that's so cool about it is it's a little bit like a small town. I have been trying to get Ed Rendell on the phone for like a week and a half. And nobody would usher me into his presence. And so I looked out the window. We're at the old Inquirer building on Broad Street. And there was a parade coming down the street. And I know 2 things about Ed Rendell. If there's a parade, he's in it, right? So I ran out and went out on the parade, and sure enough, there he was strutting down the middle of the street. And the second thing I knew about Rendell is if you got him in front of you and asked him a question, he could not help but answer the question. So I got my interview as we marched.
It is such a great place to do journalism, and I had such a fabulous time here. It was maybe the most fun in my career, and I learned more than I did any other place and made such good friends. I loved it here. Yeah. I loved it, and it was not easy to leave, and that's why I'm coming back. So anybody who's in the real estate industry, I'm not paying any 6 or 7% interest rates, by the way.
You write in your book, you know, that clearly for somebody who loves their work, the issue of how to stop doing it looms larger. than for other people. Yeah. But there's another aspect to writing a column in a major metropolitan newspaper, and that is that people walk up to people like me and say, do you know Steve Lopez? I mean, that you have a presence as a result of the work you do, the platform that the paper gives you. So when you give up that work, you're giving up more than just that challenge and the work that you love. You're giving up something that touches your ego.
It does. It's, I would say that in the last 10 years, you do get the ego strokes. You also get savaged on a regular basis, given the state of social media. I mean, I regularly get just savaged. It's a polarized, political culture. And you could write a column saying it was a beautiful sunny day and be trashed by somebody who thinks there's some ulterior motive.
Right. Profanely trashed.
Yes, yes. No, it's not always pleasant. And it's a sad commentary. But no, I do feel really, really privileged. I don't feel like at any point in the last 50 years I could even call it work, because I enjoyed it so much. And I thought of a column as having a running conversation with a city. And the kind of column I write does not work unless the conversation is going two ways, and that people are sending me their thoughts, their reaction, and their ideas. I'd say, looking back over all of these years, probably a third to a half of my better columns came from readers, because they were my eyes and ears, and they were having experiences that I thought made for good stories. And so your identity becomes very much a part of the work you do. And I began wondering, as I contemplated retirement, whether, when I walk away from this job, who am I? If I'm no longer the guy that somebody wants to either thank, applaud, or savage, who am I? And you're suddenly anonymous. And I worried a lot about that. And I also gave a lot of thought to how so many other people must experience that, and that's why the book is full of people who don't have very public jobs. But if you're a teacher, if you're a nurse, if you're a police officer, you're expected to show up, and you matter. And I think just about everybody who has a job matters to somebody. And when you step away from that, you've got to create a new identity, and I wasn't sure what mine would be. And so I was really conflicted about it.
Well, one of the things that you've done a lot in your columns, and in Nathaniel Ayers is just one example, is that you've befriended the people that you've met in your reporting and have stayed friends with them. Can you talk about some of the folks that you write about, some of them in your book, who have become your friends through writing about them?
Well, Nathaniel has become a dear friend in many ways. Nathaniel, is, as you mentioned, is the musician. One of the first people I reached out to was when I was considering retirement, was a good friend named Jim Ritchie, who had been a colleague at the LA Times. He retired kind of early. I think he was 62, early 60s. And I asked Jim about identity and what was it like? What was the first day like when you no longer have this thing to do that you worked hard to get to be a journalist? And now it's behind you. What is it like? And I said to him, look, I've just been out on this story where I wanted to find different ways to write about climate change. And Allison and I had been to a wine tasting in Santa Cruz. A good friend set it up with a guy who's sort of a legendary winemaker. His name is Randall Graham, and he had the moniker the Rhone Ranger, because he brought Rhone blends to the United States. And Allison and I were having a tasting at his place in Santa Cruz, Bonnie Doon Winery. He had Cardinal Zinn and a number of other really popular red blends. And he mentioned to me that there are always these challenges in winemaking. There's, you've got pests to deal with. And he said that there was not nearly as much fog in Santa Cruz as there had been when he started making wine. I said, what do you mean there's not as much fog? He said, oh, it's got to be 30% less fog. And I said, why is that? And he said, this channel runs off the coast of California from way up north, and if it warms a half a degree, everything is thrown off. And when you have less fog for grapes that like the fog, then you're in trouble. And I made a mental note of it, and I went back and wanted to do a column on how climate change was impacting the California wine industry, which is a multi-billion dollar industry. And I thought, here's an identifiable way to write about this for people, anybody who enjoys a glass of wine. So I was sitting up there at Randall's vineyard with him, where he is trying to create a climate change resistant grape by doing, he's grabbing these stocks and doing all of these, he's blending different grape varieties to create a grape that is more heat resistant and can handle less fog. And he brings out all of the wines that he's making. And we're sitting on a table under an oak tree, and we're along the central coast of California. And I asked him if he ever thought about retirement, and he said, no, I'm gonna die in the vineyard. And he said, why are you? And I said, yeah. I said, I'm thinking about, I've done it for a long time, and I'm ready to try different things. There are, other things I think I might enjoy. And he said, you're sitting here with the Lone Ranger. We're drinking wine in the middle of the day. You're getting paid. What are you going to do in retirement that's better than this? And it's, well, Randall, thank you for pointing that out. But Jim said to me, Steve, I understand that. Jim, my friend, said, but did you really experience being in that vineyard with Randall? Or were you thinking the whole time, what is the lead of this column? Did you really have the experience? Or were you there just to take notes and write about it? And did you, in fact, maybe miss the experience? And I thought that was profound. And I do wonder if, I do wonder what that other world might be like, where I do things for the sake of doing them and really am, having a deeper experience than the ones that I have where I've got a notebook in hand and I've already written the lead
right
before I'm done with the interview.
Yeah, I agree. That is a profound insight. So,
why do you keep writing so much then?
I don't know. I don't think profoundly. That's my problem. So, you came up with you've met a lot of people who've approached retirement, their older years, in a whole variety of ways. But you kind of came up with three possibilities for yourself, three broad possibilities. What were they?
Refresh my memory. What were they?
Well,
I wrote the book a long time ago.
One was reinventing yourself and stepping away from it altogether.
Yes.
Another was you're going to just keep on working until you drop. And there are some folks that you write about in your book who just love their work and can't imagine not doing it anymore. So that was another extreme possibility.
Yeah.
And the third was your hybrid plan.
Thank you for reading the book.
So
that you can help me through this.
I'll expect you to have read my next book.
By the way, we need to talk about that before we leave the stage. You got to come back here because Mark's got a book coming out in April that we were just talking about at dinner. That sounds like you're all going to want to get this book. As I wrote, Mark, I gave myself a one-year deadline. I thought the book needs, as my agent would say, a tick-tock. Let's give it a time element. You're setting yourself up in 1 year to figure out your future. And part of what motivated that was that I felt like I was on my parents' health malady calendar. All of the things that happened to them were happening to me at the same age. They both died of congestive heart failure. I had a knee replacement 10 years ago and went into cardiac arrest and was resuscitated and left the hospital with a pacemaker. And I thought, I don't know how much time I have left. And am I going to be one of those people who waits to retire and plans all of the retirement activities I want to do, and then when I finally do it, I don't remember Allison's name, or I'm too hobbled to go somewhere because this happens. This happens. And so I was truly, truly conflicted. And the one option, just keep doing it, because if you enjoy it so much, why not? Go and reinvent myself and do these things like, study, wine or music or language and just get totally away from what I've done, because why not have a different experience than the same one I've had my entire adult life And among the people that I interviewed were Mel Brooks and Norman Lear, because they're in their 90s. Norman Lear is now 100. But I thought, okay, those guys are in their 90s working as hard as ever, as much as ever. And I wondered, what I wanted to ask each of them was, if you're in a creative field, and not that writing a column is necessarily the most creative work that can that's been done on the planet, but you stare at a blank page and you got to fill it with something. And my concern was, if that creative energy is oxygen, do you suffocate when you walk away? And am I going to suffocate? Because there's not a day, there's not an hour goes by that I don't see something, think something, and my instinct is, can't wait to write about this. And so when I called them, they both had their advice for me. Norman Lear said, I thought also quite profoundly, life is you're swinging in a hammock between what happened yesterday and what's coming next. And life is all about what's over and what's next. And if something gets you out of the hammock, go and do it. Don't nod off because you might not wake up. And he said that he had 100 years of great nexts. And he said, as long as you're feeling the tug, just honor that. And Mel Brooks said, let me get this straight. You like what you do. I said, yeah, I love it. I feel privileged. I've got a license to drop into people's lives, go where I want and ask questions and write about it and learn from people. And he said, but you might want to live on a kibbutz, or you might want to live in Barcelona and become a flamenco dancer. And I said, yes, these are the things that I'm conflicted by. He said, now here's what you do. Mel Brooks is my life coach. This would not have happened if I stayed in Philadelphia. And he says,
he's famous for being the 100-year-old, or was it 1,000-year-old man?
2,000-year-old man. Yeah, with Carl Rayner. So he says, go to the editors and tell them, you like your job, you want to keep it, but you don't want to do it every day. Go with a hybrid plan. You get the best of both worlds, you idiot. What's the problem here? So it was good advice from Mel Brooks, and I took it. So I'm a hybrid guy now.
Right, or you're trying to be. You started this new column with an idea of what, writing?
I am trying to be a hybrid guy.
Yeah, you're but not here's, so here's necessarily the thing. Succeeding.
I got this idea for this column about aging because you were talking about some of the numbers. We are racing for the first time in human history to the time when there are more people over 65 than under 18. I mean, think about that. It's coming up in several years. And it's like climate change. We are not prepared. And it's a tsunami coming at us. Some people call it the silver tsunami. And among the many challenges are, we haven't figured out the housing. Where and how do people live? We haven't figured out the health care. California alone projects, by 2031, a 3.2 million person health care worker shortage for the rapidly exploding aging population. And I thought, there are all of these issues around aging that are going to become center stage, and I don't think that we're focusing enough on them. I'm going to write a column on those things because I'm experiencing some of these aging issues myself. And so I wrote the first one maybe a month ago saying, here's my new column, this is what it's going to be. Send me your, please send me your ideas. How's it going? I want to write about the blessings, the burdens, the challenges of aging, how people are reinventing themselves. This is not all bad news, but tell me your stories. I've had over 3,000 emails. Now, when Mel Brooks said, so you take it easy a little bit, you go hybrid, I did not anticipate having to pour through 3,000 emails, but that's what I'm doing these days.
And you're also writing more than you anticipated, right?
Yes, and there are great nuggets in there. You gotta go sifting for gold. I'm looking through them one day, and I see a guy says, my name is Benny Wasserman. Benny said he's 88, has prostate cancer that he's being treated for. And every Friday, he wakes up, puts on a Detroit Tigers uniform, goes to the batting cages near Disneyland, called Home Run Park and hits pitches off a 90-mile-an-hour pitching machine. And he said, my goal is to do this in another 15 months when I turn 90. I'm calling it 90 at 90. I said, Benny, I'm going with
you. You gotta go.
So I went, and Benny Wasserman, let me tell you folks, the Phillies don't have a bad team, but you know, you need some bench strength. Benny Wasserman can hit. He said, if I hit a home run, it makes my day. There's a wall out there, and if you hit it over that beam, it's a home run. He hit three home runs. He hits 90% of the 90-mile-an-hour fastballs.
That's amazing.
And he's hitting line drives at 88 with prostate cancer. Yeah, and he said, by the way, I was an Einstein impersonator. I said, what do you mean? He said, yeah, I got laid off in aerospace. I was 58. I thought, what the hell am I going to do now? And he said, somebody looked at me one day and said, anybody ever tell you you look like Einstein? And he said, no, why? So I said, so how did you get into that business? And he said, I called the Ben Franklin lookalike in Philadelphia. The Ben Franklin lookalike is his agent. It's Benny's agent. Ben Franklin is Einstein's agent. You know, why would I retire from this, Mark?
I know, seriously. Yeah, I mean, the world is full of things that you just could not make up, right? So one of the other themes in your book is about your youngest child, Caroline, who was getting to the age where she's looking at colleges and getting ready to leave. And as you said at the outset, that this was not a prospect that you welcomed. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, people think from the column that I write that I'm a hard ass, and at times I am a little bit, but I'm really a softy, and Allison and I have a healthy and great marriage, and it's not like we don't have things to talk about and do together, but it wasn't just that she was leaving, it was my age. It was, you look back and you see the life that you had, and you realize that you're in the last quarter of it, maybe, if you're lucky. And I just had so much trouble thinking that that was all behind us. And that not only was she leaving for school, but she might never again be back permanently. And I just thought of all the things that I would miss. It's like when Jeff and Andrew moved on. It's like your life really changes. And some people, it's like, you know, good riddance. It's time to live it up. I didn't feel that way about my kids. And I'm, you know, fortunately, because I took the Mel Brooks hybrid plan. And in my case, what I did was I said, look, I'm going to take a 25% pay cut, if you'll go for that, and I'm going to work only 9 months. I've got 3 months off. So our daughter plays tennis at Denison University in Ohio, and we, where's the chair for Denison University? Did nobody here go to Denison University? So we go see her play tennis quite a bit, and that's what we're doing with our time, and it gives me a little more time to hook up with Andrew and Maggie, and I don't know, it's
Was hitting you at the same time where you were thinking about retiring. And
yeah, the double void. It's like you're...
Most people, when their kids leave home, they're not really at retirement age yet.
Did you have to point that out? You know, that is a very good point, and you're right about that. It's like usually you're what? You're
in your 40s or early 50s or something.
Oh, what did I do wrong? what happened?
You screwed up your
what
life,
happened?
Steve.
But I think it is, yeah, that it was because I was so much older. Yeah. And because I so enjoyed being a dad. Yeah. And you're still a dad, but, you know, I think I've texted my daughter 3 times today and she hasn't responded. So.
Well, allow me to plug the grandparent experience. That's something you have to look forward to.
Yeah.
One hopes, so.
And you have how many grandkids?
Just two. Wish I had more, but I'm working on the other boys. So. There's only so much you're allowed to say. All right, I think we want to take some questions from the audience.
This is a question maybe for both of you. Writing nonfiction is more expensive than fiction because you have to do research. You have to take time out. You know, take subjects to dinner or buy drinks. So, what advice do you have for like an aspiring nonfiction writer? How do you fund that?
I think Mark's probably better.
Well, my first advice would be try to choose projects that won't cost you a lot of money, and don't take people out to dinner if you could avoid it. You know, I used to tell my students, that if they think they need to travel around the world to find a good story, they're not paying attention closer to home. So I think you build a reputation for yourself by writing great stories. And if those stories initially are in your zip code, all to the better. You're not spending a lot of your time and money. And then ideally, you know, that will lead to more people being interested in your work. But it is a real issue. I mean, one of the real tragedies of the decline of major metropolitan daily newspapers is that the experiences that I had at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I was being sent overseas in my 20s to do really ambitious reporting assignments, those kind of things are not happening as often, and just in large part because there aren't as many newspapers, and even the ones that are around are not as ambitious as the Inquirer was when I started. So it's more difficult, but it's definitely doable. And I think if everybody was just writing great stories about where they lived, we'd be getting a lot of great stories from everywhere. Steve, do you want to add to that?
I think you covered it.
Okay.
Will you be the person to write the delicious political stormy and loving bromance between Donald Trump and Frank Rizzo? This idea came to me, and I can't let go of it. I can just see him stooping Rizzo to run against Fetterman, and that in itself would have been such a delightful face-off. But these two titanic egos, it just seems to me, and I'm not
this,
the one to do it, but I just love
this again
the idea.
Is a question for Mark.
I don't know. I think you're the humorist of the two of us. So, but no, I have no
I like
intent.
That. That's a great novel. What do we owe you?
I think you should go do it. You seem to have a sense of what it would be.
I will say in connection with that question there that sometimes it's difficult when you can't make up anything wilder than what really happens. And that would be the challenge with that. It's like, that sort of thing could happen, next week.
You wrote about the Badlands in Third in Indiana. In your trips back here to Philadelphia, have you been to that area in the last X number of years? And have you had the opportunity to look at the new Badlands, which is Kensington and Allegheny?
I've not been back up there for quite a while. I took one trip up North Broad and then Ridge with Sister Mary not that many years ago, and was startled to see what I saw, the transformation of Ridge, which when I was working at the Inquirer was, quite... homes had literally fallen in on themselves and become piles of bricks, and I drove up there with Sister Mary. You know Sister Mary, who's just down the street here, with Project Home, one of my all-time heroes. And she drove me up, and bricks were pointed, and storefronts were cleaned up and painted. And I said, Sister Mary, who did all this? And she said, our people, Steve. And I said, what do you mean, your people? She said, all the people, like the ones you knew when you lived here and came and hung out, people whose lives we helped resurrect. And we trained them in the trades, and they're making a big contribution to restoring this neighborhood. I haven't been to like K&A, I haven't been to Third Indiana in quite a while. I know there's been a lot of gentrification in Philadelphia, and as all of you know, gentrification has winners and losers in every city. And that's no different here. In Los Angeles, we have so many people driven out of neighborhoods they've lived in for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years because of what's happening with real estate prices. But I'd like to go back up. And I mean, it's unfortunately, when I'm in Philadelphia, it's a brief tour, and I'm gone again off to the next thing, which is why I need to get that house here.
We'd like for you to come back.
So, Steve, you have this insight into what's happening with the aging population, and you likened it to the pandemic or to climate change as being so massive, and yet we're blind to it. Can you say something about our blindness? I mean, why we're so attached to looking at the ground when we ought to be looking up?
What I hope to look at with this project is ageism, which you know, is a very real factor. We have in California, and to maybe a greater degree than you have here, real estate prices that are unsustainable for people on fixed incomes, and we haven't really figured out. The two big questions are: how will you pay your bills? And who will take care of you? Because we're many of us headed to where we cannot take care of ourselves. And in Los Angeles, we just had a proposition on the ballot called the Mansion Tax. And it was a tax on real estate transactions above $5 million. There'd be an added real estate transfer tax to go into an affordable housing fund and a homelessness prevention fund, targeted specifically for veterans and for seniors. Because I just did a column on Skid Row in Los Angeles where seniors are the fastest growing population of homeless people. So we're going to see this kind of thing happen in communities across the land, because by nature of that boomer wave, which is cresting, and the lower birth rate, we have fewer people paying into the institutions that support aging. And we don't make healthcare support for the aging very lucrative. And it's a particular problem in a place like Los Angeles, where it's $15 an hour to take care of somebody who doesn't have long. And for $15 an hour in Los Angeles, you cannot live anywhere near the person you're taking care of. So there are some major, major social policy, political decisions that are gonna have to be made, and we're gonna be forced to make them, or we're going to have millions of older people suffering, and it's already happening. You know, while I was working on that column on Skid Row, I got an email from a guy who is 102, World War II veteran, lives in a one-bedroom apartment in Hollywood. I'm going to see him when I get back next week, and got his gas bill, $514, for 1 month for a one-bedroom, because that commodity spiked, the prices spiked. So what do you do with people like that? What is he supposed to do? And while I was talking to him, I could hear his healthcare worker, and I asked Paul to please put her on the phone. And she's making $15 an hour. She's living, you know, like an hour and a half commute to get to this job, and she's got her own housing issues. Just magnify that millions of times. That's where we're headed. And some people are fortunate enough to have enough money put away, or they bought long-term, you know, health insurance. Most people have not. And on the subject of retirement, I wanted to make the note that now's the time to do it. Those of us who can decide whether it's time to retire are, in a way, very lucky, because a lot of people don't have that option. There are so many people in this economy which works for a few and crushes the many, who are going to be working as long as they're alive, because they've how else to pay the bills?
Right.
So I wanted to begin writing about those things on a regular basis, you know, develop a foundation so that I can write with a little more authority on all of those issues around aging. And hospice, my parents both had bad hospice experiences. Hospice is generally great, but it's become corporatized. It began as a nonprofit industry. It wasn't about how do we profiteer on taking care of dying people. It was, how do we give people in their last days and weeks some comfort? It's now corporatized, and that means staffing, you know, shortages. And that means that it's tough to get the nurse or the doctor to come and see somebody. And it means all sorts of other problems associated with hospice. So I want to write about all of those things and make that my focus for at least the next year or several.
But I want to read about Benny Wasserman hitting home runs.
Since you're talking about the cost of hospice, I just want to also bring up Alzheimer's. You know, my aunt has Alzheimer's, and the cost of caring for somebody with Alzheimer's, that's also privatized, and that's very, very expensive. And it seems that Alzheimer's is on the rise. So how are we preparing for that?
Well, thank you for that, and you're absolutely right. Those are questions that I think we're going to have to address in the very near future because, like I say, I think it's, is it 2030 when we have more people over 65 than under 18? And we just have not figured out very much of that. And California, I should say, a couple years ago drafted and enacted what's called a 10-year plan, a master plan for aging. And it has five goals to achieve in the next 8 years. And that's another reason I wanted to start this column, is to be sort of a watchdog on that. How are they doing? Are they succeeding at all? Are they keeping pace? And you bring up a very good point. And, you know, it's so many, I've heard from so many readers who are suffering in so many ways. I've got a whole heading under loneliness from these 3,000 emails that I've gotten from people who are emailing me to say, we're alone. We're lonely. What do we do about that? And what kind of social policy might make it easier for people to get together? There's an Annenberg center in Koreatown in LA that is addressing that very issue right now and going out into neighborhoods and recruiting people to get them into what's sort of a senior center on steroids, where it's like learn new ideas and social, you know, create new social networks. I mean, people who age well have friends and family and a feeling that they matter. I think it's about place, people, and purpose. We all just want to matter. And when I was interviewing Nancy Schlossberg for this book, 92 in Sarasota, she said, you know, in your retirement is a major, major transition. Everything will change. Your relationship with your spouse, your relationship with your former colleagues, your relationship to the world around you. And you'll find that often people who have successful sorts of retirements are people who find purpose, who find that they've created some reason to matter. Maybe they volunteer. Maybe mattering is just walking the dog or taking care of the grandchildren because it's a service to your kids. But there are so many people who are in isolation, who don't have any kind of a social network, who don't feel that they matter. And so that's another whole area that I want to write about in this column. And also the Benny Wassermans and some upbeat ones. There's a 91-year-old jazz drummer in L.A. Steve Heidegg is his name. He fled Hungary in 1956. He had worked in a movie theater as a teenager, saw American movies with bands like Count Basie and Tommy Dorsey, and he said, "What is that stuff?" Somebody said, "That's jazz. It's American." And he said, "That's what I want." And he fled under cover of darkness and went to New York. Paul Jablow, a big jazz fan, is sitting here in the front row, and we used to go to concerts here in L.A. together. Or in Philadelphia. Where am I? So anyhow, Steve gets to New York, works as a janitor. They wouldn't let him to Juilliard. He goes to L.A. And in L.A., he goes to the Musicians Union, introduces himself, and forms a bunch of big bands. And he had a long career as a jazz drummer. And Steve recently took a fall in his one-bedroom apartment where the rent is higher than his monthly Social Security. And when I first wrote about Steve 5 years ago, one of the people who donated $45,000 was a guy by the name of John Densmore, the drummer for The Doors. So I recently had lunch with John Densmore, and I said, Steve took a fall. He's injured his shoulder, and he's still drumming. He's teaching drumming, and Densmore said, "I got to see that." And I said, "Okay." He's got a jazz session at Stein on Vine, this iconic L.A. jazz hangout. So I went with John Densmore from The Doors, and he saw Steve teaching a jazz class, and Densmore jumped into the band.
So I can tell you that Steve's never going to stop.
I'm sorry.
Thank you all very much for coming.
We need to talk about our band.
Well, we still have time. Go ahead, tell them, Steve, real quick.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.